So we're continuing in this series, Open Invitation, this tour through the Gospel of Luke, looking at this theme of how Jesus widens the invitation for people to come to God, how the borders of the kingdom of God continue to expand and to grow, and the margins continue to be pushed further and further out. And today, we'll be looking at a passage continuing on in Luke chapter 6. The title of the message is How to Save a Life, which ties in with the message of this healing that happens in a synagogue, but yes, is also a little shout out to the fray. Anyone? How to Save a Life? Yeah. You know how old that song is? 2009. That song is like 12. It does not feel like it. 12 years old, that song, How to Save a Life, if you're familiar with it. So anyway, we're going to be talking about how Jesus is present and how life is restored in this story in Luke chapter 6. So let's pick it up. I'll be starting in verse 6 and reading through verse 11 today. On another Sabbath, he went into the synagogue and was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was shriveled. And the Pharisees and the teachers of the law were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. But Jesus knew what they were thinking, and said to the man with the shriveled hand, "Get up and stand in front of everyone." So he got up and he stood there. Then Jesus said to them, "I ask you, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it?" He looked around at all of them, and then he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He did so, and his hand was completely restored. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law were furious and began to discuss with one another what they might do to Jesus. Sometimes it's not enough just to claim something. Sometimes it's not enough just to say something with authority. Sometimes you have to do something to back it up. In order for people to believe you or to believe in you, sometimes it's not just about what you say or what you proclaim, but it's about what you're able to do to give evidence for what you say with your words. In other words, sometimes you have to back up what your words say. And this is perhaps best shown in the classic scene from the classic movie, A Christmas Story. When Schwartz and Flick are discussing on the playground, you know, this whole idea of whether or not your tongue might stick to a flagpole in the middle of wintertime, they go back and forth. And if you're familiar with the film and the scene, you know, things get escalated and the word gets uttered, "I dare you." And then pretty soon, "I double dare you." "I double dog dare you." And then eventually the coup de grace, "I triple dog dare you." I don't know if that actually happened. I'm not going to try, especially today when I was like 12 when I got up. Triple dog dare you. In other words, I hear your claim, so I want to see you back it up. I hear you, what you're saying with your words, but I want to see some evidence. And you might be thinking, what does this have to do with anything at this point, right? It's not even Christmas anymore. We're past that. Well, here's why. Because I think the story we just read is actually a way for Jesus to give evidence to a claim. It's a way for Jesus to put his actions where his words have already been. Because in the story we looked at last week, the conclusion of that story was a claim by Jesus in verse 5 of Luke 6 when he said, "The Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath." That is a bold, bold claim. We talked a little bit last week about how that there's such boldness for any Jewish teacher to go so far as to claim to be Lord of the Sabbath. So I think what we see here is Jesus giving evidence to the claim. He has said, "I'm Lord of the Sabbath." They don't believe him. They're angry with him already about that. But now he's going to show them on Sabbath how he has lordship over the Sabbath. And he chooses to do it in a way that is controversial. Even though it's life-giving and restoring, it's a way that is controversial. Which got me thinking, I don't want to spend a ton of time on this, but it really got me reflecting this week on us today. Because Jesus gives evidence to his claims. He doesn't just say things. He does them. And more people swell in wanting to follow him. I just wonder, friends, if maybe the world around us would be more open to a Christ-shaped way of life if the church displayed more evidence in the form of life-giving hope and healing to the world around it. If we move past just saying things. Because we can say whatever we want. But I think in the world in which we live, if people don't see anything to go along with what we say, I don't blame them for not being interested. We can say that we are people of mercy and compassion and justice and truth and love, but if people don't see evidence of those things in our lives as individuals and corporately, guess what? I actually don't blame them for not being interested. We can say whatever we want, but we need to give evidence to the world of the words that we use. But let's move on. In this particular story, we read about a man with a shriveled hand. Luke's account is unique in that it says it was the man's right hand that was the shriveled hand. I don't know how much significance to read into this or not. I know in ancient times, left-handedness was frowned upon, and so the fact that he had to do everything with his left hand might have been an issue. Those of you who are lefties, you maybe already know this, you are very fortunate to live in these times when you are not looked down upon and frowned at because of your left-handedness. The Greek word for withered suggests that this hand is atrophied or maybe even paralyzed, perhaps as the result of an accident. So when you read a shriveled hand, don't read like, oh, like when I get out of the bathtub and I've been in too long and I'm pruning. No, this is not that at all. This is most likely someone who had some sort of accident and his hand is now paralyzed, unusable for him in his day-to-day life. There are some second century commentaries that float the idea. I don't know how much validity there is to it, but float the idea that this man was a mason or a bricklayer. And that's even more detrimental because if you're in that line of work and you have an accident that crushes your hand to the point that it's no longer useful, you don't even have the ability to provide for your family anymore. Not only is your life in need of restoration, your family's life is in need of restoration. I love how Jesus knows exactly the situation he's in, though. Because it says he knows what the Pharisees and the teachers of the law were thinking. And instead of doing this healing in a way that's concealed or sort of off to the side, what does he do? He says, friend, I want you to come up here and I want you to stand in front of everyone. Now, I'm totally with Andy on the interpretation here. When I read the story, I picture the guy with a shriveled hand like way in the back, like near the exit, kind of trying to hide. He doesn't want to be seen by people. I picture him being on the margins, the edges of his social world. And when Jesus says, come to the front and center, I see him going, I'm good here. Thanks. I don't need to be any closer to the front. But he does. He comes and he stands up front because Jesus wants this not only to be a healing moment, but a teaching moment. Yes, it's about this man being restored and healed, but it's also about what can be taught in this moment when Jesus heals this man on this day in this place. But before he does, he asks this question: what is lawful on the Sabbath? To do good or to do evil? To save a life or to destroy it? If we pause on the surface, this question is ludicrous, right? Because is it ever a good idea to do evil? No. Is it ever a good idea to seek out destruction? No. Those things aren't to be pursued on any day, let alone on a Sabbath day. This is one of those questions that's not a question, right? It's never okay to seek evil or to seek destruction. But there's a little more to it because of the Sabbath interpretations happening in Jesus' day. We talked a little bit last week about, you know, the tasks that are prohibited and allowed. But now we get to another part of that, those layers of interpretation for what is and is not okay on the Sabbath. I read this week that this is the Sabbath and a man is healed. And there may have been differences of opinion concerning Sabbath observances. The Jewish teachers in Jerusalem favored a very strict understanding of Sabbath rules and guidelines. Some of the Jewish teachers in Galilee favored more lenient understandings of some of those Sabbath guidelines. But there was a rule that both embraced, and that you were only permitted to heal a person on Sabbath to treat them when their life was actually in danger. That's it. Break a bone on the Sabbath? No, too bad. Stay comfortable, we'll set it tomorrow. And the only time that you could help is, let's say that you have an accident where you are bleeding profusely and it's possible that you might lose enough blood to lose your life. They could put some sort of like paste on top of your skin to stop the bleeding, but that's it. Just to prevent you from dying. Nothing else could be done until Sabbath was over. To understand why the Pharisees and teachers of the law are watching intently. Is Jesus going to violate that law? Because this man with the shriveled hand, is his life in danger? No, certainly not. But similar to last week, we're looking at these layers of interpretive guidance that got piled on to how do you honor, how do you respect the Sabbath? Well, let's take a moment, though, to remember the original intent of Sabbath, the context, the original purpose for Sabbath. Why was Sabbath given in the first place? What did it mean? What was it for? One of the big things, I think, is the idea that if God was able to rest in the creation of the world for an entire day, surely you can take a break and the world will still function. I know for some of you, you can't even imagine. But yes, you can take a break and the world keeps turning. There is a place for rest, a place to step back. But it was bigger than that, because the people who received this Sabbath command, if you read Exodus 20, those people who received the Ten Commandments, including the command for Sabbath, had recently been slaves in Egypt. And a big part of Sabbath was tied to them no longer being slaves. The Sabbath became a practice not only as a space for rest, but also a reminder, maybe you've heard this before, that you're not a human doing, you're a human being. We can get those things mixed up from time to time. See, a slave in Egypt was simply a human machine for getting things done. There was no day off. Probably not even a coffee break. Nothing. Because all you are is a human machine. But when God liberates his people, he teaches them immediately through Sabbath, you are not a machine. You are an image bearer of God. Take some time to remember that. You're not a machine. You bear the image of God. It's about being free from what holds us captive. One of the quotes I read this week in a commentary, Jesus looks back at the original intent for Sabbath, a reminder that Israel was once enslaved. His point seems to be that the Sabbath was meant to be a time of release from that which enslaved people. It was always about deliverance from oppression. And in this case, the oppression is the physical ailment which plagued this man, the man with the withered hand. And a step further, the law about Sabbath was never designed to restrict one's ability to love and to meet needs. Compassion is always appropriate. Doesn't matter what day it is. Kindness is always appropriate. It doesn't matter what day it is. Now, when we think about Sabbathing today, we need to think a little bit critically about it. We've talked about Sabbath for a couple weeks. Now, last week we talked about Sabbath. This week we talked about Sabbath and how Jesus sort of butts his arguments against those religious leaders on what Sabbath is for and what it does. The New Testament gives us an entirely new view of Sabbath than what we get in the entire Old Testament. For instance, in Romans 14, Paul's writing this letter, and he says, one person considers one day more sacred than another, but another person considers every day alike. Each of them should be convinced, fully convinced, in their own minds. This is a part of Romans chapter 14, where Paul is getting to these disputable matters among Christians, among brothers and sisters in Christ, things that are disputable. And it seems within the very first generation of the church, the hard and fast rules about regarding Sabbath were already becoming loosened and maybe even set aside entirely. Guys, there's not a lot of time between Jesus in that synagogue and then Paul writing later. Saying, well, if you consider each day to be similar, just be fully convinced in your own mind. I'll go further and say if you read Acts chapter 15, you read about that council that came together to figure out how do we do this church thing when these Gentiles want to join us Jewish folks. Because they're coming into this whole thing and they're focused just on Jesus. We've got all this stuff that we've been believing and talking about for generations. How do we make all this work together? And eventually the council meets and convenes and sends out this message to these new Gentile churches. Here are the few things that you need to worry about, that you really need to focus on. And guess what was not included at all? Was Sabbath. No rules, no regulations regarding how to properly do Sabbath in this early church, this group of people intent on focusing on Jesus. So I would argue that it makes no sense to me to have really, really universal rules for Sabbath keeping from a Christian perspective. There aren't. Now listen, if you want to do Sabbath from a Jewish perspective, I got loads of codes for you. I can give you piles and piles of stuff. You can figure it out. But from a Christian lens, a Christian perspective, it seems just from Romans 14 and Acts 15 and passages like that, that some sort of universal, uniform list of do's and don'ts doesn't actually make sense within Christianity. Now you might be tempted to think, great, we'll just throw it away. But I want to urge you, please don't do that. And here's why, if for no other reason. In a world today that is growing in its busyness and complexity and engagement all the time, don't we need Sabbath and what it provides kind of sort of more than ever? I think we do. The world around us seems to be constantly growing in busyness, complexity, and a desire for us to engage. We are expected to squeeze more and more activity into every single day. But do you know what every single day has in common? 24 hours every time. You think you can do more? No, you can't. That's all you get, 24. But we're constantly pressured to squeeze more and more in to eat every single one of those 24 hours. We're expected to understand more and more things as our world is constantly saturated with more and more information all the time, especially in the age of the internet. It's just endless. And we are expected to engage people and ideas and news in a seemingly endless cycle. We need Sabbath so bad in a world like that. But I'm not going to give you rules, because I promised I wouldn't. But I have three suggestions to try and think about how to do Sabbath well, how to do Sabbath in a healthy manner from a Christian's perspective. Here's the first one. Free yourself from something that otherwise has a hold on you most other days. You know, the idea of seeking out freedom from something that, you know, maybe oppresses you or just something that holds you tightly. When you Sabbath, don't do that thing. Whatever it is, something that wraps its arms, if it's friendly, or tentacles, if it's not friendly, around you, don't do that thing when you Sabbath. Suggestion two, celebrate the sufficiency of God for you, for your family, for your city, your town, your nation, your world, for all of creation. Celebrate the sufficiency of God, because, spoiler alert, God doesn't need you. Now, he loves you desperately and deeply, but God doesn't need you. God is totally self-sufficient on his own and sufficient to meet all of our needs. And part of Sabbath is remembering the sufficiency of God. And then here's the third suggestion. Do something that refreshes or replenishes you, whoever you are. Not going to give you a comprehensive list, but here's some suggestions. Do you like to read? Guess what? Read. Do you like to write? Write. Do you like to garden? Garden. Well, not now. Don't garden now, please. Your neighbors might think you're crazy. Do you like to take pictures? Do you like to scrapbook? Do you like to crochet or catch up with a friend or take a nap or watch a movie or go for a drive? Whatever it is that restores within you your fullness of a sense of being human, do that thing in order to set. So that's what I've got. No rules, no regulations, but three suggestions on Sabbathing in a healthy way from a Christian perspective. But let's wrap back into the story one last time. Let's try and start landing the plane, shall we? Because we see Jesus heals, front and center, heals this man with a withered hand. He clearly ties himself to what's happening with this man's healing and restoration. What if you were there? How would you have responded? If you were in that synagogue watching all of this play out, what do you think you would have done or said? Would you have been sitting there in amazement? Probably. Would you have been astonished at this upstart Jewish preacher, rabbi, who now is also a healer? Probably. I would argue your most common response might be joyous celebration for your friend Bill, who now has a good hand again and could go back to work. You would be joyously celebrating the restoration of your friends. Amazement, astonishment, joyous celebration, all of those things make a lot of sense to me. How did the Pharisees respond? They were mad. They were angry. It gets translated furious in the Bible. The Greek word for furious refers to a blinding, irrational rage that is similar to insanity. They were blinded with anger and rage after witnessing a healing. Right? That should not make sense to you at all. How can you ever respond with anger and rage at the sight of a healing? I think part of it is when we get blinded by or lost in our own sin, we can no longer do what we're told to do in Romans 12 when it says, mourn with those who mourn, rejoice with those who rejoice. They can't rejoice with Bill because they're blinded by their own sin. But here's the biggest thing. Here's why I think the Pharisees reacted with rage and anger instead of joy and celebration. And we find it tucked into verse 7 of what we read today. And I'll quote it for you. They were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus. And they found exactly what they were looking for. When they entered in to that synagogue on that Sabbath day, the lenses through which they viewed everything was looking for a reason to accuse Jesus. And they found exactly what they're looking for. So here's my question to you. What are you looking for? Because guess what? You will probably find it. I don't know what Bill was looking for when he came to the synagogue that day. I don't know what his neighbors were looking for. I hope they were looking for a time of worship, a time to meet with God and with one another. What are you looking for? Because you will probably find it. I had a friend recently share with me a devotion about vultures and hummingbirds. Vultures and hummingbirds. And I could just ask you right off the top before I give it to you, would you rather be a vulture or a hummingbird? I hope that's an easy choice for you, just based on pictures alone. But here's the story goes like this. Both hummingbirds and vultures fly over our nation's deserts. I looked up the initial usage of this story. It was from Reader's Digest in 1990. So it goes way back. But hummingbirds and vultures both fly over our desert areas in this country. And what are vultures looking for? Dead things. Rotting meat. The carcasses of animals. That is what they are looking for. They thrive on that diet. What are hummingbirds looking for? Those colorful blossoms and blooms on the desert plants, because that is what they live on. The vultures are seeking out what is dead and gone and rotting. The hummingbirds are looking for what is alive. They're looking for new life, and they fill themselves on freshness and life. Both of those birds find exactly what they're looking for in exactly the same space. What are you looking for? Because I bet you will find it. Are you looking for good, for healing, for restoration, for hope? You'll probably find it. Are you looking for evil or destruction or division or condemnation or revenge? Guess what? You will probably find it. So a few things to consider and reflect on and pray about this morning in response to the way Scripture speaks to our hearts today. Here's the first one. Ask God to strengthen you and your fellow Christians to live out more evidence for the Lord be proclaimed to follow mercy, justice, compassion, truth, sacrificial love. Because, guys, we can say anything we want, but the world needs to see evidence of some of the claims that we make. Second, looking back over the last weeks or the last months, how do you personally engage in Sabbath keeping? How do you honor it? Is it a gift? Is it a burden? Is it neither? And what could you do differently that would give you a weekly sense of life-giving restoration? Lastly, in the recent past, what have you been finding when you observe the people and the events happening around you? And do you think that what you're finding just might be affected by what you're looking for? So I'm going to cycle through those questions one more time as we have a moment of silence to allow the Holy Spirit some space to speak without outside distraction into our own hearts. And then I'm going to close that time of reflection with a word of prayer. As we cycle through the questions, at any moment that you feel something that you want to discuss with God, feel free, close your eyes, bow your head, whatever's helpful.